Hello, and welcome to episode 28 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and as always, I'm here with my ever-reliable co-host, David Grigg.
Hello,
David.
Pleased to be called reliable. Thank you, Perry.
I'm here, David. How's the lockdown treating you? Things are a little bit looser now.
They're starting to be, but we haven't yet really taken full advantage of that yet. We still haven't seen my daughter and the grandkids for a while in physicality, in the flesh.
For a while.
So
yeah, it's a bit strange because you can see them via video and
we sort of have seen them across the width of a garden. So we've kept our distance, but We're hoping to get a bit more close in the coming weeks, I guess.
That's fine.
But I'm keeping myself busy. I'm doing all sorts of odd little things and keep myself occupied in all sorts of ways. I'll talk to you at some stage about my new Raspberry Pi, but that's another story altogether.
I have been doing
a fair bit of reading too.
That's good to hear. So have I, as it comes to that.
So what have you been reading?
Well, as you know, it's Hugo Award time. While the voting ballot itself, I still haven't seen the shortlisted works for the Hugo Awards for this year's World Science Fiction Convention were released 4-6 weeks ago, something like that.
Yeah, sounds about right. Yeah,
and I've been gradually working my way through all of the major fiction categories. So that's basically what I get to at this time of year. That's the novel, novella, novelette, and short story. And I'll describe those in a bit more detail in a minute because it's worthwhile knowing what those categories represent in terms of word length because it's fairly important. But it's interesting that I put a note about the fact that I had finished reading all the Hugo nominees up on Facebook. I got a couple of interesting reactions. So one person wondered why I was so excited about it. And I explained, well, it's not so much excitement. It's more a matter of I want to be able to vote in the Readers' Awards. It's the only award for science fiction that I'm allowed to vote on each year because I'm not a member of the Science Fiction Writers of America. You may be eligible, but no, you're not. Okay, well, I'm not, that's for sure. Never having had a piece of fiction published anywhere in the universe, as far as I'm aware. I've written some things which are close to fiction, but that was more in a business sense, making things up as you go along.
It wasn't fiction about the numbers at the bottom.
No. Numbers are sacrosanct. You know that, David. Us being both IT practitioners in the past, numbers and data is sacrosanct, and you can't go anywhere near that. No, it's the interpretation of it and how you utilise it that you might want to have a bit of fun with from here and there. Anyway, that's another life. That's gone. We don't need to worry about that anymore. So basically, my aim is to read the Hugo nominees so that I can vote, and I want to be able to, if possible, get to read all of it so I can vote by basically saying, I have read it all, and I can say that of the ones that I've read, this is the one that I consider to be the best.
Sure.
Now, that can be a bit of a trial, and some people have noted that they're really quite disappointed with the way the Hugos have gone over the years, and a lot of people have almost given up on them because they don't believe that they are showing a true reflection of the best works in the field.
Yes.
Now, I know that I gave you a couple of short fiction, two short stories and two novelettes to read. Now, we won't get to those today because there's too much to get through, so we'll get through those next week.
Yep.
And you can have your say about those next week. That'll be good because it's worthwhile listening to other people talk about what they see as the good and the bad in those nominee lists. And maybe there might be something there that some of our listener might decide they want to go and have a look at. Or not. Now, Hugos, these are the ones that are reader voted. You have to be a member of, now I'm going to get this wrong, and I'm sorry if I do. You have to be a member of the current or the previous Worldcon in order to be able to nominate.
Yes.
Possibly the future one, but I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think it's certainly the current one and possibly the previous one.
Yep.
In order to be able to nominate. In order to be able to vote, you have to actually be a member of the current Worldcon. That is, the Worldcon at which those Hugo Awards are going to be presented. In that case, in this case this year, that is New Zealand. As we know, there's a bit of a problem with New Zealand in that it's going to be a virtual convention, but they will have the Hugo Awards as a virtual online ceremony. I guess what they're going to have to do is try and get everybody in on a Zoom meeting and have them all lined up, and everybody goes a bit like the Academy Awards when nobody, you know, how they have the shots of all of the people that have been nominated and the winner of the best actress is, and then they cut to the person who wins it. And they all start screaming, all that sort of stuff. So maybe, hopefully, that'll be this case. That'll be fun.
Could be fun, yeah.
Yeah, it could be fun. It'll be good stuff. So the organising committee has a subcommittee. And now you should know about this because you actually were the subcommittee.
I was the subcommittee.
You were that subcommittee in 1975. Yes. So 45 years ago, David.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, now... I can remember having been a chair and somebody ringing me up and sort of saying, look, it'd be really nice to know if such and such a person had won the award this year so that we could make sure that they were available and they could come along and pick up the award. Stony silence on my end. And then I said, well, I can tell you I know nothing about it and I will not know anything about it. But you're the chair. Don't you know everything? About this convention, not that part of it. It is completely arm's length, and only the subcommittee people and those that are authorised to know are allowed to know what happens with the Hugo Awards. So that's an interesting way of doing it, and it works pretty well. It seems to go quite well, and it seems to be fine. So anyway, David, to the categories. Now, there are four major fiction categories that we would like to have a look at. The ones that I'm interested in are the novel, the novella, the novelette, and the short story. Now, the novel is defined, for the purposes of the Hugo Award, as a work of science fiction or fantasy of 40,000 words or more. The novella is 17,500 to 40,000. The novelette, 7,500 to 17,500. And the short story is less than 7,500 words.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can quibble with those definitions if you like, but they're the ones that have been in place now for quite some time, and I think they're pretty reasonable. Those bottom limits seem to fit with my view about how the differentiation between the categories should work. So I'm happy with them, and I think everybody else is, and they've stayed pretty much that way. Now, I'm not entirely sure exactly whether the Nebula Awards are exactly the same. Some of their limits might move a little bit by 500 words or so, but they are pretty similar as well. So from that perspective, pretty much the same. So let's move on to the novels first off. So what I'm going to do, there are six works in each of the categories. Today we're only going to deal with the novels and novellas, because if I keep talking too long, either my voice is going to go or you're just going to go fall asleep, David, so we won't go for too long.
No, I'll be right.
So we'll start at the bottom end and then we'll work up to where I think, so from number six, how I've ranked them from number six up to number one. So number six, The Light Brigade by Cameron Hurley. I gave this a score of 3.3. Now, sometime in a future Earth, the Earth is ruled by six corporations. So this is one of those corporation-style ways of government that some people push as the future form. Now, there were seven, but there was a war that took one of them out and just totally destroyed them. So the corporations fight against each other on Earth. A human colony has been established on Mars, but that has terraformed the planet. That was always a bit of a problem for me because I would have thought terraforming Mars would have taken a heck of a long time, but anyway. And at some time in the past has broken off contact with the Earth. Now, at some time in the future, the Earth Authority, some of the corporations decide that the land on the Earth has been damaged so much that they get the Mars colonists to come in to re-establish, reinvigorate the Earth. But some of the remaining corporations don't particularly like this very much and start a war on both Mars and the Earth-based Martians. Now, our main protagonist, Dietz, the main protagonist of this novel, joins up with one of the corporation's army when her city of Sao Paulo is destroyed in the war. Now, in order for each group of soldiers to travel to Mars for the war, they are sent via a form of matter transmission, which becomes clear does not work all that well and does strange things to a small group of people, sending them off into different time periods so they don't end up exactly where they thought they were going to be in terms of the time period, but they do in terms of the location. Hmm. Now, these people are called the Light Brigade, hence the name of the novel, and Dietz discovers she is one of these. She slowly realises that she was able to predict her future events as she had lived through them in some sense. So she's jumping around between one point in her future timeline and another. And then she realises that she can change the war's outcome if she reaches the correct timeline in the right sequence. Now, the main part of the action is a total mystery to Dietz, as she never knows where she's going to be after each transmission. Now, unfortunately, the same can be said for the reader and for the bulk of the book.
Oh,
and I really struggled with this because I think I sent you an email after I'd read about 80 pages of this book and said it's a rewrite of Starship Trooper.
Yes.
Starship Troopers, sorry. Now, the difficulty I had was I'd read Starship Troopers only a couple of months ago. And at 80 pages, I thought, oh, my God, are we going to get the whole thing all over again? Well, we don't, actually. It does change, and there is some differences in this. But I found it very confusing. I really struggled with it, with her jumping from different one timeline to another. And I didn't ever know where I was. And that sort of raises the question, I suppose, David, is it, in your view, necessary for readers to be taking notes when they're reading a novel in order to keep track of where they're up to? I would have thought that was the novelist's job.
Yeah, no, I think that sounds like a not well-structured book.
Yes. Now, Cameron Hurley's written a few other novels, and I've read one other, and I thought that was okay. This one, didn't work for me.
Never mind.
Number five, The City in the Middle of Night. There was a fair bit of buzz about this. This is written by Charlie Jane Anders, and I gave it a score of 3.8. Anders won the Nebula Award for Best Novel in 2017 for her book All the Birds in the Sky, which I really quite enjoyed. And in some ways I enjoyed this book as well, but, and there's always a but. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let me describe it. The planet January is a tidally locked world, with one very hot side turned towards the sun and the other in eternal darkness and cold. Now, some hundreds of years prior to the start of this novel, humans have colonised the twilight zone between the two extremes, building one major city in the shadow of two mountains and one further into the twilight zone. And then you find out that there are other towns and other cities and other settlements all the way right around the twilight zone band of this planet. Now, the novel follows two points of view. That is Sophie, a young woman who's exiled from the major city, which is called Zyosphant. When you get X's into things, it really throws things off. And Mouth, who's the last survivor of a group of nomad traders that was moving from one place to another. Now, the two of these start out in different parts of the city, and the novel's told from the two different viewpoints, and after a while they gradually come together through their mutual friend Bianca, who also is a major character that runs all the way through this book. Now, all three of these people, plus Mouth's friend Alicia, free the city after a political purge of dissidents and end up in Argello. It's even a little bit easier to spell, which is the second major human city on the planet, which is vastly different from the other city. Now, when the first humans arrived on January, they believed that there was no sentient life there. You know, analogous to the terra nullius view of Australia by the British, that there was nothing there, that nobody owned anything. There were creatures there, but None of them they considered to be were sentient. But Sophie makes contact with the crocodiles, and I'll put those in inverted commas because that's what the humans on this planet call these creatures,
mm-hmm.
who she comes to realise are the planet's indigenous intelligent life form, and who have been gradually geo- and bioengineering the planet for millennia. Because you've always got this problem of a tidally locked planet that, how do you control the climate with the hot air going from one, streaming from one side over to the cold, and the cold air going the other way, and yet we're not having these big storms. So somehow or other, something has impacted the weather on this planet. And then I thought, okay, so it's impacted these people, the crocodiles, or Jellet, as they come to be called, have bioengineered the planet.
Okay.
But how did they get there in the first place? Mm. I mean, they must have been there in a time when the weather was absolutely atrocious. How did they even... it becomes too difficult when you get right back into it.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a lot of interesting things here with the aliens. It's the first contact story, in a sense. And so these aliens are certainly interesting and worthwhile, would be worthwhile examining more. But more of the novel is dealt up with these heartfelt personal conversations that don't seem to go anywhere. They just seem to be repetitive between the main characters. It's like, oh, you know, why have you left me? And they leave me again. And then you do, oh, God, it just goes on and on. So basically we get to the stage where all these interpersonal problems are being rehashed time and time again. And you don't really resolve anything. And then the novel just ends. It just ends. And I turned the page and I thought, what? Surely there must be another chapter here somewhere. No, it just ended. So I was very disappointed in the ending. Yeah. I also thought the book's about 100 pages too long, which is a big problem with a lot of novels these days.
Yes.
It's 370 pages. Should have been 270, 300. So there's a germ of a good novel in here, but it just doesn't come out. So I could only give it the fifth in the batch.
In the list, yeah.
Number four, Middle Game by C. Nan McGuire. Now, you've read one of C. Nan McGuire's Wayward Children novellas.
Oh, yes. It was okay, but I didn't really like it that much.
Well, just keep that in mind, because one of the Wayward Children novellas comes up in the next category in this discussion. Now, this is a standalone fantasy novel, not to do with Wayward Children. But again, we are dealing with children. She seems to be a bit fixated with children, this author. Now, this time, the two children that are the main characters have been manufactured from conception to have special powers. This seems to remind me a little bit of a book that you read just recently, where you were talking about a
Bitter
couple
seeds.
Of children. Yes, that's right. Seems to be a bit of a trend there. Now, this follows... Now, these children are part of a program that has been run by a group of... secret group of alchemists who are trying to control the forces of the universe. Oh, God. with ultimate power and control being the aim, of course. You know, if you're going to be able to control the forces of the universe, don't you want to be God? Of course you do. Now, this follows the two children who are twins from an early childhood, and they're forcibly separated and adopted by parents on opposite side of the US. They gradually force their way so they can communicate sort of telepathically. Here we go. And sort of starts getting a little bit further and further away from reality all the time. And one of them is really good at math and is able to foresee what's going to happen and was able to manipulate time. And also space. The other one is very good with words and is able to command people to do things, and they just do them. And I got to the feeling that after a while that you start to think that these two characters really have, they sort of have, their powers are like magic. They can just be turned on and turned off whenever they feel like it. And half the time you think, why don't you do this? And why don't you do that? You've got this power to do this, but you're not doing it. And it's all done for dramatic effect. And it's a bit like Harry Potter half the time. They, you know, the characters get stuck somewhere and you sort of think, hang on. In the last book, you just went zap with the wand and just blasted the hell out of this door. Why don't you do that? Nah. So you sort of think that the magic or the powers in this instance are used whenever they feel like it.
Or whenever the author thinks of it.
Now, basically, you get to the stage where anything's possible and therefore you sort of think, oh, God, it detracts from the tension a bit. I mean... It was well written, enjoyable, but it's 500 pages, or over 500 pages. It's a big, long book. I thought, again, it was too long by about at least 100 pages. Could have been done maybe even 200 pages. It could have been tighter. If it was tighter, I probably wouldn't have had time to get to the point where I start thinking, hang on a minute, and that I might be able to get through it. But anyway, so I gave that a score of four out of five.
Okay.
Number three. Now, the next three books that we've got are all debuts, all by women, all debuts. So this is interesting. It seems to be that this has happened before where, you know, basically people have just burst onto the scene and have gone on to do wonderful things. So hopefully the next three will do that, but we'll see. Now, the first one's Gideon the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. I gave this a score of 4.2. There was a lot, as I said, there was a lot of buzz about this during the year, so I knew it was going to be on the list of the Hugo nominees, but I didn't nominate it prior to the nominations because I'd read it, but it was more on the fantasy side, and I only nominate science fiction novels or science fiction works for the Hugos, but I read and vote on anything that's on the ballot when it's there. Anyway, so this is a debut novel from a New Zealand writer who currently lives in the UK, and it's set in a universe where necromancy is the magical system in use. There are nine loyal houses for the Emperor, and the Emperor has decided that he needs a new member of the High Council called a lictor. Now, in order for one of these to be created, and one hasn't been created in 1,000 years, each of the nine houses sends one representative and one bodyguard to the Emperor's world in order to be able to choose. They don't know how this is going to be chosen until they get there and then told that there is a contest that they have to find the answer to. And somebody says, well, what's the contest? And they say, one of them, the only rule, I think, in the contest is something on the lines of, you may not enter a locked door without permission. That's it. Off you go. And so they off they run. And so there's a lot of interesting things in this. The trouble I found with the book was that it tries too hard to find its voice in the first 100 pages. And the main character, Gideon the Ninth, because Gideon is the name, the Ninth is the Ninth House, so she's Gideon of the Ninth House. She's this sort of sassy, abrasive bodyguard who is trying to escape from her own world and is not allowed to and falls for a sort of simple trap that would have been easy for, you know, 10-year-old to see, I would have thought. And gets goaded into doing something and then gets caught up again. And it takes a while for it to get going. And then when it does, it's fine. But the first 100 pages, I think, really need a lot more tighter editing to basically get it through. It doesn't all come together enough for me. There's at least another novel. This is the start of a series. I know that second novel has been written and was scheduled for publication about now, but of course with publication dates all over the place, it's going to be difficult. That's called Harrow the Ninth. I will probably read it because I gave this one 4.2, so I'll probably read that book, but, you know, I'll be looking at it and hoping that it sort of picks up a bit and that, anyway. This is third on the list. I didn't think it was going to be one of the winners, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's in with a chance. Okay. Now, the next two, 10,000 Doors of January by Alex E. Harrow, which I gave a score of 4.6. That's number two.
Yep.
And number one, the one I'll be voting for, A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martin, which I also gave a score of 4.6.
Yep.
Two. We discussed these two books.
Yep.
In episode 23. Sure. So I won't go of this podcast. I won't go into them in detail again. 10,000 Doors of January is a portal fantasy that tells the story of a young woman hunting for a father who's become lost in the portal maze of doors. It's beautifully written, suspenseful and emotional. And of this one, I wouldn't be bothered. I really wouldn't be bothered. I think this will be a lasting book, and I would recommend that people read this one. It's good. A Memory Called Empire, the one I will be voting for, is a debut space opera. which follows the story of a young woman who's newly appointed ambassador from the Lesse station to this empire. And as you recall, it's got this really strange name that I struggled to pronounce in episode 23, and I'm not going to try it again.
You're good.
And she's appointed to ambassador to this empire, and she has to investigate the death of her predecessor, and slowly discovers how she's being manipulated by the powers in the empire. I thought it was a tremendous debut. It would be a worthy winner. I'm hoping it wins. It'll be the one that I vote for, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Tamsin Muir gets up.
Sure. Well, I'm hoping that at least some of these, or at least extracts from these, will be in the Hugo voting package, which I keep hoping will turn up, but it hasn't actually turned up as
yet. Yeah, that hasn't shown up yet, which is a bit strange. It should be out by now. But,
yeah, I hope so. They usually say May, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll see.
So anyway, the novellas now. So these are the ones that are, let me see, what I would really say. There were 7,500 to 40,000 words. So short novel range. So, you know, basically anywhere between, 60 pages and 120, thereabouts, if you want to put it that way. Number six, The Deep by Rivers Solomon, which is, this is also a Nebula finalist. I only gave this a score of 2.8.
Ooh.
We read a book by Rivers Solomon a year or two back.
That's right. Oh, The Kindness of Ghosts.
The Kindness of Ghosts, which I thought was quite good, although the ending was a bit, didn't quite work.
Yeah, me too, I agree.
Now, this one deals with waterbring descendants of African slave women thrown overboard who have built an underwater city.
Ooh.
And in order to shape their own future, they must reclaim the memories of their past each year. And then one year, the designated woman rebels against the practice and doesn't want to carry on with it. I really struggled with the whole concept up front. I mean, for some reason, you know, there are just some stories that just don't grab you.
Yeah,
you just
can't
do anything with, and regardless of what it is, and this was one of them, didn't do it for me, gave it a 2.8. Who knows with this one, it could actually win, and I'm completely wrong, but hey, that's the way it goes.
We'll see.
Number five, To Be Taught If Fortunate by Becky Chambers. I gave this a score of 2.9. Four astronauts undertake a long interstellar voyage to a possibly inhabitable solar system. There they visit four separate planets in this solar system. And guess what, David? All of them, all four of them, have got life on them. How about that? Isn't that a shock? Okay, so as you can see, I'm a bit incredulous right from the very start. Now, I don't get this whole thing about Becky Chambers. She's written a number of, you know, quite pleasant novels, but she's getting a lot of rave reviews about stuff, and I just don't get it. I mean, good titles. I mean, Very Long Voyage to a Small Angry Planet was a good title.
Yeah.
Not a bad book. I thought, yeah, good throwaway stuff, and it gets up on the Hugo ballot. And I thought, what? How did this get here? Same thing with this one. She has a habit of basically telling you everything, all of her research, and this novella is about 130 pages long, and the first hint of a plot doesn't turn up until page 80.
Oh dear.
And you know, normally by then I've given up, but in this instance I decided, well, I better go through it. It was a struggle, just a struggle. Look, it's a light and easy read, but I don't think it's up to the standard of a Hugo winning novella myself. I just don't think it's there.
Okay.
Next one, Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom by Ted Chiang. This was published in his Exhalation collection of short stories. This is also a Nebula finalist at a score of 3.0. This is number four, so I'm counting down. So in a future world, quantum entanglement has been harnessed to allow people to be able to communicate with their alternate selves in other timelines. Quite interesting idea, you know, that you can go and talk to yourself to say what happened here and what's the difference between your world and mine, and what have you done, and how can I make my world better and your world better, and what have you learnt on your world that we don't know here that I could possibly make and sell. But Chiang's style just doesn't work for me in this. He lectures and info dumps too much. There's just massive awaits. I kept on waiting for a story to happen. I kept on, and there's nothing to think about here because he just supplies it all. You come away from it in the end, you think, okay.
Mm.
And there's just not enough story to be able to sustain the concept that he's trying to get at. And it's as if the story was tacked on to the original concept that had been thrashed out as research. So it was a bit like the Chambers story, but written better. So, you know, not there for me. I gave that one 3.0. Number three, The Haunting of Tramcar 15 by P. Digelli Clark, which is also a Nebula novelist. This one was a jump in quality, absolutely, from the previous three. So this one got a score of 4.0. Mm-hmm. And it's quite an interesting concept because it's set in Cairo in 1912, and there's something haunting Tramcar 15. Now, Senior Agent Hamed is fairly certain it isn't a ghost and thinks it might be a djinn. That's D-J-I-N-N. Uh-huh. Although a lesser djinn, and not one of the djinns that have been allowed in the real world for the past 50 years. Yeah. So there's this setup of djinns have just basically moved in. They just hang around and people deal with them as if they were just strange people from another world, and everybody's fine. Now, the alternate Cairo world-beating here is handled well, and Clark writes a good story. And it's interesting, it's amusing, worthwhile reading. It's not a winner, but I think that if people read it, they'll enjoy it. It'll be fine.
Okay.
I gave that one 4. So number two, this is where we come to the Sinan Maguire again. This is In an Absent Dream, which I gave a score of 4.2 to this one. This is number four in Maguire's Wayward Children series of novellas, and it's a prequel to the one that you read, Every Heart a Doorway. Okay. And that the therapist in that novella, who's a woman who's stuck in an eight-year-old's body, is the main character in this one. And then you find out how it is that she came to be stuck in this eight-year-old body. So Catherine Lundy walks through a door as a six-year-old into the world of the Goblin Market, Christina mm-hmm. Rossetti's Goblin Market. So it's that world that she walks into. And while she loves it while she's there, she's stuck with longing for the old world, and in the end she bounces backwards and forwards and has to make a choice, can't make up her mind, and ends up finding herself stuck in this world forever in the body of an eight-year-old. I thought this is good. I enjoyed this. I mean, I like this series. I think these are quite good, and I would recommend them to people. It's a possible winner, but hey, it's just potluck, really. Now, the last one, and the one that I'll be voting for, is called This Is How You Lose the Time War by M.L.L. Motar and Max Gladstone. I gave this one a score of 4.4, so it doesn't round up to 5, but it's getting up there. Now, this one, the background is an epic time war raging over centuries, and the foreground story is a love affair between two women on opposing sides of that war, the blue and the red, who leave messages for each other in various places up and down the timelines, who gradually realise they're in love, and the only one that really understands them is the other one in the relationship. I thought it was handled pretty well as you could, because you could really lose control of this very easily if you weren't careful. A bit like the Light Brigade, where they lose control of I thought the author lost control of where things were going in the fragments of timeline. This was reminiscent of Time Was by Ian MacDonald of a few years ago.
Yes, as you were talking, it sounded to me a bit like that.
Yeah, and so I don't think it's as good as that, which again brings me back to the feeling that I was really disappointed that Ian MacDonald's novella did not make the shortlist that year. I don't think it won a bloody thing anywhere, which is really disappointing. Not even in the UK. But anyway, I think this one's probably the winner. So overall, look, normally I'd say that the novella length is the one where the best SF is being published these days. But I don't think this is a great year for it. There was these three. There's probably a couple of others that weren't on the ballot that were probably going to be okay. The top three that I've listed. The Maguire and the Motar Gladstone novellas are the standouts. But I'm actually guessing Chang will win this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why it should. It's just that every time he's nominated, he wins. Mm-hmm. So while I'm going to be voting for one particular novella, if I was a betting man, I'd stick a lazy couple of bucks on Chang to get up down the outside, David. But all these things are a lottery, and who's to know?
Oh, indeed, yes, it varies, yeah.
So that's enough from me for the Hugos for this week. That's quite enough. There's a fair bit of reading there and a fair bit to get through. But
yeah, well, I'll try and catch up with some of that once I get the Hugo voting package of it. But yeah, it does sound to me like a lot of the really interesting writing in the field just doesn't end up getting nominated for these awards, which I think we've discussed that in the past, and it's certainly been my feeling. And nothing you've said today makes me want to change my opinion. So we'll talk about the shorter fiction next week, which I have read. So next episode, I should say.
Well, remember that we both thought that Infinite Detail was pretty yes. good that we read this year, and I nominated it, didn't get on the ballot, which is a disappointment. Hopefully it'll pick up something in one of the others, one of the UK ones or one of the quirky awards like the Philip K. Dick or the John W. Campbell Award, one of those two. Hopefully that'll get there.
Yep.
But that's enough about what I've been reading, David. What have you been up to?
Well, I haven't been reading a lot of individual books because I've been reading a couple of very long books. I know this shouldn't be an excuse, but it is. And so I've talked quite a bit about Hilary Mantel's The Mirror and the Light. So I won't go to any great length talking about that. But just very, very briefly, it's about Thomas Cromwell, who rose from kind of very low beginnings as a blacksmith's son, first to become a trusted assistant to Cardinal Wolsey, and then after Wolsey falls from grace to become the right-hand man of Henry VIII. So if this were Game of Thrones, you'd say that Thomas Cromwell became the king's hand. It's really that sort of position, trusted to do everything. Cromwell, who navigates Henry out of his first marriage to Catherine of Aragon and allows him to marry Anne Boleyn, and then in turn sets up Anne's downfall after she fails to produce a male heir so the king can marry Jane Seymour. And it's a very well-travelled period of history in fiction, so Mantel brings a really interesting spin on it, I think. Cromwell's a really strong character, and sometimes you'd say he's doing things which are evil, and other times you'd say, you know, he's really got his heart in the right place and he's trying to do the best. Like in this book, he really tries to do the best for Lady Mary, who's Catherine of Aragon's daughter, and who at this stage has been declared to be a bastard. But he really tries to bring her back and back into the court. So it's a really interesting book, and it's written from an interesting point of view. It's all written in the present tense. It's all written from a point of view which you would think ought to be the first person, because it's really all the time you're inside Thomas Cromwell's head. But it's all written in the third person. And so there are occasionally times where it's a bit tricky to work out who the pronoun he refers to. You sort of, you get these little bits where you think, hang on, he did that. Oh, she means Cromwell did that. So it can be a bit puzzling to work through that. But anyway, I really enjoyed it. The first couple of books in the series, which were Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, each won the Booker Prize. And it wouldn't be surprising to see this one also win the prize, unless people think, oh, she's had her Guernsey. Yeah, we'll give it to someone else. But anyway, I really enjoyed that. That was great. But that's a very big, thick book.
If she does win the Booker Prize this year, she'll be the first one ever to win it three times.
Indeed.
Because there's only been a couple of others that have won it twice.
Yeah.
Peter Carey being one, and J.M. Coetzee being another one.
Yeah, yeah. So I say it may be that people think, oh, no, she's had her turn, but we'll see.
Look, the various interesting people, even Kim Stanley Robinson's been reading this one, and he really greatly enjoys it. So, yeah, I think that a lot of people have saying very good things about it. There's a lot of buzz about this one, for sure.
Yeah, sure. The other interesting thing about it is it both begins and ends with an execution. So
always fun.
The one at the beginning is Anne Boleyn's execution.
And oh, okay, yeah. That was
a very gory description of the aftermath.
That really was botched, that one, as far as I can recall.
Oh, no, she was okay. This is where they got the French swordsman.
Yeah, okay.
And he did a very clean job,
apparently. Oh, okay.
But I say there's some brilliant writing, but I won't quote it because it'll turn people's stomach. Anyway.
Good. Oh, good. Thanks for that, David. Thanks for thinking of us.
So from going to sort of this really serious, historical, kind of depressing sort of book, I thought I'd talk about a children's book I read. Because I think I mentioned a couple of episodes back that I'd read this book of essays by Philip Pullman called Demon Voices. And there's a number of books in there, books for young people that he recommends. And so I've been following up some of them. Some of them have been by Pullman himself, but some of them have been by others. I just wanted to talk about this one because it's such a delightful book. And it's called Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce. It was published originally in 1958. And it's probably aimed at early teens or, you know, pre-adolescent, I suppose, age range. So the story is that young Tom, this is all set in England, young Tom has to leave home and go and stay with his aunt and uncle one summer because his brother's come down with the measles. His aunt and uncle aren't used to children, and they live in this kind of mansion that's been cut up into individual little apartments, and they just live in one of these little apartments. So he has a really boring time in this apartment until one night he's lying awake feeling sorry for himself, and he's listening to the grandfather clock in the hallway downstairs chime the hours. And when it strikes 13, he wonders what the heck's going on, so he sneaks downstairs to find out what's going on. And he opens the back door and he discovers this wonderful garden lit by moonlight, wonderful garden that he's never been told about. He thinks, you know, why didn't my aunt and uncle tell me about this great garden? I could have been playing in there the whole time. But of course, when the daylight comes and he tries to go back into the garden through the door, it's not there. There's just a little concreted patch with rubbish bins in it and so on. What's going on? So anyway, over a whole period of nights, every night he's able to go back. Once the clock has struck 13, he's able to go back into this garden. And he strikes up a friendship with a young girl there who, of all the people in this garden, she's the only one who can see him. And she thinks he's some sort of ghost. And he thinks she's a ghost. And so there's this really nice little relationship goes on. And it goes on and on. They get this very deep relationship. And she keeps growing older at a rate faster than he is. Like, he keeps going different nights. And every time he goes, she's quite a bit older than the last time. Anyway, it ends up beautifully. It's a really nice story. And if you like reading this kind of children's fiction, I think it would be well worth having a look at.
A portal fantasy again?
Except there's only one portal, I suppose. Yeah, in a sense it is.
In a sense.
It's good. It's a very nice little story.
It's an interesting genre that when you actually start talking about these various books from the past and those that have been published now, you're starting to see there's a few of them around.
Yeah, indeed. Well, so this was written in 1958, so she was ahead of the field. And anyway, the other book, the other three books, I suppose, I've been working through, and I still haven't actually finished because it's actually a very long set of books. I hadn't realised. I actually did a bit of a count, and I'll mention what it is first. Now, this is the Lioness Trilogy by Jack Vance. And it's three books, and I did a bit of an estimate of the number of words, and I think it's over 400,000 words. So if you're reading it as one chunk, that's not too much individually for each book, but as one great big book, which I'm trying to read through in one great chunk, it's a bit of a struggle. So I'm not quite at the end of it, but I wanted to look at that in a good deal more detail. So I actually talked to friend of ours, Rob Durand, who is one of the principals of Australia Press. I'll bring up the interview very shortly. At the time I did the interview, I'd only got halfway through the second book in the series. So Rob sort of says, you shouldn't have read it all. So anyway, I hadn't quite got through it. But it's a fantasy trilogy. And I just love his work. His ability to create these very interesting societies and very interesting environments for the stories that he writes in the science fiction area are really, really unparalleled. I think he's a great writer, and I think he's a bit neglected these days. So I thought it would be a good idea to have a chat to someone who was as big a fan of, or even bigger a fan of Jack Vance than I am, which is Rob Durand. Today I'm talking to Rob Durand, who, like me, is a very enthusiastic fan of the writing of Jack Vance. Rob is a long-time science fiction fan and was one of the principals of the Australian publishing house, Australia Press. I should say Australia Press, shouldn't I? Which we featured in episode 22 of the podcast. So, hi, Rob. How are you today?
Good, David. How are you going?
Pretty well. So, I thought I would start off by doing a bit of a quick background about Jack Vance before we really get started. So, Jack Vance was born in 1916. And died in 2017, having reached the venerable age of 96. He started writing in the early 1950s and won his first major award, the Hugo, for his novella The Dragon Masters in 1962. In his life, he was given the World Fantasy Award for Life Achievement in 1984. He was made a Grand Master of the Science Fiction Writers of America in 1997 and was inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame in the year 2001. And he was a very prolific writer, completing more than, by my count anyway, 40 novels in the genres of science fiction, fantasy, and crime. I've never read any of his crime books, have you?
Yes, I have, all of them.
You've read all of them? We'll talk about those a bit later on. And, of course, he also wrote very many novellas and short stories. So, Rob, what was it that first sucked you into the writing of Jack Vance? Did you have a particular book or story that pulled you in?
Actually, first, he started writing it, publishing in the 40s, not
in the 50s. 40s, okay. Thanks for the correction.
Yeah, he had a few stories in various other magazines, but his first big book was 51, I think, which was, retitled Maziri and the Magician, but it was published as The Dying Earth.
Oh, okay, so that was his first big novel.
I think I'd read some of his stuff, and I picked up from the old Franklin's bookshop in Russell Street, which used to have a whole lot of science fiction at the back, a copy of four short novels called City of the
Chesh.
The Cash, The Wank, The Gnome, The Durder.
This is the Chai series. I don't know how you pronounce some of his names.
They were, on the surface, just very good adventure stories, but in fact, there's a lot more subtlety to it. There's great world building, fantastically interesting cultures of the different places that Reith, the protagonist, gets involved with at different times. And even though it's not the very best fans, it in some ways exemplifies a lot of his great qualities. And then I read some of the Kurt Gerson revenge novels, the Star King and...
Yes, the Demon Princess series, yeah.
And I liked them very much. And then whenever a Vance story appeared, I'd look out for it and read things like Araminta Station when it came out. I don't know if you've ever read that one.
That's one of the ones I haven't read, I don't think.
It's a big environmental natural world. And so it's in some ways a political novel. But again, it's terrific. And then when I got to reading a couple of these short stories, like there's two that stand out to me that are perfect as short stories.
Yes.
One is Green Magic. It's a short story that appeared, I think, in Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. And it's about a guy whose uncle had dabbled in the magics, and he found his notebook and despite all the warnings followed him, and beautifully captures Vance's ironic and sardonic take on humanity, because throughout all his writing, he's quite a satirical writer in a gentle sort of way.
Yes, yes.
His choice of words is always very astute. And he's often very amusing and funny, or funny even, laugh out loud sometimes with some of his stuff.
Yes, yes.
And the other story was The Moon Moth, which appeared in Galaxy. Probably about the same time as Green Magic appeared, I think. From memory, it was about 63, and Green Magic was around about 62, 63. I don't know if you've read The Moon Moth.
No, I haven't. My reading of Vance is much less than yours, even though I think I read most of the novel series. I haven't read a lot of short fiction.
Well, The Moon Moth, which a lot of other people also rate very highly, it's a world where you have to, in order to communicate, you need to wear a particular mask, which in a way reveals your status.
Yes.
And the consul from Earth has arrived and he's trying to investigate a crime. And he has, I think he wears the Moon Moth mask. But as well as that, you've got to play a musical instrument when you talk. And so people have all different sorts of instruments to demonstrate different subtleties or nuances of meaning. And this poor bastard has tried desperately to learn because he's regarded as the lowest of the low when he arrives because he's got no skills in that and he's got... Anyhow, again, it's a very witty story. And in 30 odd 40 pages, he captures a whole culture in living detail, and plus a very interesting detective story, I suppose it is, plus a very superb science fiction story. So it's got a lot going for it.
Yes, indeed.
And around about the same time, he wrote another great short novel or novella called The Last Castle, which appeared in Galaxy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Each of the things that I read enriched my feeling for him. So I sought out other books of his, and all of them seem to be unique in how they took a story, even if it's a conventional one, like whether it was a detective story, whether it was a space opera. It always, through the characters, through the colour, through the cultures, through the disdain for religion,
yes,
always I found interesting. Yes. That's a longish answer to a short question.
No, it's a good answer, and a good way into his books, I think, to start by reading those I don't know how to pronounce it, Shai novels, which are really interesting because they're set on a world in which there are four independent alien species knocking about with humanity, and he in turn gets involved in each of those different alien species. But my introduction came through reading The Dragon Masters, and that came about by the fact that I'd been given, and I've talked about it a little bit on the podcast, I'd been given this wonderful gift of a series of Galaxy magazines stretching from the 1950s through to the mid-1960s. And I sort of worked my way through those, and I came across some wonderful works like Alfred Bester's The Stars of My Destination and things like that. But one of them was The Dragon Masters by Jack Vance. And the thing which sucked me into that in particular, I have to say, wasn't initially the writing. It was the wonderful illustrations in that magazine edition with Jack Gaughan, which are wonderful, wonderful, creepy pictures of these aliens and these humans. Because the very clever concept of the story is that there's kind of been a first contact between humanity and these aliens who were kind of like lizards in some sort of ways.
Reptilian.
Yeah, reptilian, yeah. And the interesting thing is that each side, they're sort of at war, and each side has captured prisoners from the other side and bred them for particular purposes. So the alien side has got these hulking great humans who are there just to carry heavy weights and drag things around, and as well as many other types of human. And the humans have got these aliens that they've bred up to be attack animals, to be fierce creatures to attack someone else. Because it's a wonderful concept, this mirrored breeding on each side. And it's a wonderful story, and I say it was the wonderful illustrations of Jack Gaughan that dragged me in. But the story itself was really repaid reading, and it was well worth that. And so I think from there I went on after that to I'm pretty sure the first thing after that of his that I read was the Demon Princess series,
yes.
Starting with Star King, which, as you say, is a revenge series of revenge novels. Because Gersten has his parents have been killed by a raid of these crooks, basically these five individual very prominent princes of crime, and each of the books in the series follows one of Gersten trying to get revenge on one or other of these individual characters, the demon princes. And so it's great, and it's interesting how that series, Gersten's attitude to the villains changes. There's an arc in the story, isn't it? Because by the end, certainly by the second, the penultimate book, The Face, he actually starts to sympathise a bit and actually does something to further the plot of one of these crooks. I don't really want to talk about that, but I just love that whole sort of arc of which I think that whole series he wrote over quite a considerable period of time, didn't he? It took him a while to actually finish it.
It did, and it's interesting you mentioned the face. I think he wrote the first three books fairly close together, then a bit of a gap for the face, and then a bigger gap for the Book of Dreams, the last one.
Yeah.
But if you think about, we won't give away what happens in the face, but the idea that finishes the book is pretty mind-boggling when you think about how did he come to think of that as a way to
to get his revenge. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very clever. So yeah, that was it would have been, I think I probably only read The Star King and what is the next one? The second one is the Palace of Love, is that right?
Yeah,
the Palace of Love. Yeah. I think I read those two pretty closely to that get together. And then eventually, like you, I discovered the Shy novels and went through all those. But they're so cleverly set up. It's wonderful. So
The last book of that series, The Book of Dreams.
Yes.
Has a great resonance with two other Vance books and possibly with Vance's own upbringing. You might recall that the last of the Star Kings, or the last of the villains, who's the key person in the Book of Dreams, as a child, had a book which he wrote down in different coloured inks, the different personalities that made up his own personality. And in a book called Bad Ronald, which came out in the 70s, which is not science fiction, Ronald is a boy who also has a fantasy life which he records in a book with different voices. And in one of the crime books, The View from Chickweed's Window, Chickweed has a book in which he's written various personas in his imagination.
Mm, no, so it's a common thing.
Chickweed is a boy. It's a beautiful book. It really repays reading. There's so many different levels you can see in it. He isn't using these dreams for criminal purposes like Ronald or the protagonist in the Book of Dreams, or the antagonist in the Book of Dreams.
Howard Allen Treesong.
But in reading Jack's own memoirs, he did something similar when he was young as a coming up writer. He would do all these different things in different coloured inks and maps and cultures and
I can imagine that.
Images of how they were looked and stuff.
Yeah, he obviously puts in a huge amount of effort into creating these scenarios. I mean, that's one of the things which is so attractive about his work, isn't it? It's these exotic scenarios, exotic places with wonderful names. He has a wonderful facility with creating the names of places and people, for that matter. And great ability to describe scenes and places, and this creation of these sometimes weird cultures. I suppose if you said looked at his science fiction, you'd say that it's really all set in the same sort of universe where humanity has spread across the galaxy into all these many planets, and on each of these individual planets, human society has gone its own individual way. And so you end up with this vast cornucopia of different societal types. He has a wonderful imagination to pick up the ideas of these. And in the novels like the Demon Princess novels, Gersten visits so many of these different locales and you get to see them all. It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Well, in his novel Big Planet, which got published in magazine form in an abridged version, and the integral edition has restored some of the lost stuff, but in fact I think another third of it ended up on the cutting room floor somewhere and it's lost forever. But in that, the whole postulate is that it's this huge planet, the party from Earth crash lands and they have to go across to the other side of the globe, and they traverse these different cultures all the way through.
Mm.
And so it's always been a strong part of his writing from the 50s onwards. And
a lot of them are what you call a picaresque sort of novel.
Yes. They're
novels of a voyage or of a travel through a varied landscape.
And also he often writes a personal story of someone growing up. So whether it's in the Book of Dreams, the villain childhood, and you can see how he was bullied at school and then he got his revenge on various people as an adult.
Yeah.
In Inferio, one of his very best books, the hero is the son of a woodcarver, mm-hmm. and the culture is a bit like in Bali where you make a living by doing your art, but other people make all the money out of you. And by the time the book finishes, there's a bit of a complete upheaval and revolution of that particular culture. In the Blue World, again, there's a young man brought up in this very rigorous society living on floating pods in the big ocean with a big kraken providing a possible threat.
Mm.
And that's the Blue World. Apparently Vance was living with his family, with Frank Herbert and his family in Mexico.
Yeah.
And they were talking about writing a novel about sitting in an ocean or sitting in a desert, and they tossed, and Frank Herbert tossed the desert and did Dune.
Wow.
The ocean and did The Blue World.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. That's a wonderful story. That's great. I didn't know that at all. And then there's his fantasy work, which meant to finish rereading the Lioness trilogy, but I didn't quite get into it quickly enough, so I'm about halfway through the entire trilogy. But that's one of the best fantasy novels or series of novels which have ever been written, I think. Again, because...
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, Lord of the Rings is one of the great pillars because he did so many things for the first time. But Lioness, you can't say it's better or worse than Lord of the Rings, but it's as good as. But in its own way, it is just an extraordinary creation.
Yes, yes. And again,
it's a joy for you to haven't yet finished it.
I have read it, but not that long ago. But yeah, I meant to reread it before this, but didn't get through to it, through all the thing. But I'm halfway through The Green Pearl, which is again, as you talk about his comic sense. Yeah. There's a lot of comic sense at the start of that, where this evil Green Pearl goes from hand to hand and bringing problems for every person who steals it or takes it on board, and it's very funny, a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, Vizboom, for example.
The other thing which strikes me in rereading Lioness, is it Lioness or how do you pronounce it, Lionessa?
Lioness.
Lioness, whatever. Lioness, let's say Lioness.
That's with a French tinge on it.
A little tinge, yeah. Which is supposedly set in early prehistory, really, isn't it? Or the sort of the time of the Celts and the Druids and so on in Britain. But these islands, which didn't really exist, but these imagined islands like Lioness and some of the other islands there, which are just off the coast of Britain.
Yeah. It was set about the time of King Arthur.
Yes, yes. There's a sort of feel of that to it, isn't there, too?
In fact, King Arthur's round table is a table in one of the courts
on
Lioness.
Yes, yes, that's right. But one of the things which struck me in rereading it is how much pleasure Vance obviously takes in talking about food. Did you pick up on that? every time there's a meal, I mean, every time anyone has a meal, you get a description of what's in it. It's not, sometimes it's brief, but you always get a bit of an indication. But I came across this one, which I just have to quote because it's lovely. That it is admittedly a banquet, so he's gone into more detail than he usually does. But we just like to read it. So this is in The Green Pearl, the second book. So the banquet proceeded. The first course, a mince of olives, shrimp and onions baked in oyster shells with cheese and parsley, was followed by a soup of tunny, cockles and winkles simmered in white wine with leeks and dill. Then in order came a service of broiled quail stuffed with morels, served on slices of good white bread, with side dishes of green peas, artichokes cooked in wine and butter with a salad of garden greens, then tripes and sausages with pickled cabbage, then a noble saddle of venison glazed with cherry sauce and served with barley first simmered in broth, then fried with garlic and sage, then honey cakes, nuts and oranges, and all the while the goblets flowed full with noble philospa and sansui from Watershade, along with the tart green muscat wine of Dacinet. So, I mean,
that's fantastic. I'd love to eat that meal.
It could come out of a cookery book, couldn't it? It's just wonderful. So it's just this wonderful sense of description he's got, and he applies some of that to scenes that he describes as well. But it was just the thing about the meals which I picked up on rereading Lioness.
You also notice that the which often occurs in these books, that he has a thing about landlords ripping off their guests.
Yes.
And so you've got to be meticulous in how you negotiate how much you're going to pay for some food or for a room or whatever.
Yes, yeah. There's some lovely things in there. All right. The one thing I did want to talk about before we're done is we could spend days talking about Jack Vance's books, I'm sure. But one thing I did certainly want to talk about is the Vance Integral Edition. So what is it and what was the idea behind it? And I know you did get involved in that.
A guy called Paul Rhodes was also a great Jack Vance fan. Oh, he's a great Jack Vance fan. And I heard somehow that he was getting a group of people globally through the internet to try and restore Vance's work to how he had written them, because many of the works being published in the pulps suffered from the hands of editors who were more or less brutish in how they treated his work. And I put my hand up to be a volunteer, and they've got a list in the front of each of these editions which has the people involved in that particular book.
Yes.
And so I proofed some of the things. It went through various stages, and there were about, I think, 150 of us in all. And it was the first time the internet had been harnessed to do this sort of work. And so some people would find the original papers at Boston University. I think there was a repository.
Uh-huh.
And on the back of one of his novels, they discovered one of the novels that was published as by Ellery Queen that had been edited for the house style of Ellery Queen.
All right.
So the Vance edition has now been able to publish, integral edition published, close to the original Vance versions of those four novels.
Great.
And they also repay reading.
When was this, Rob?
2001.
2001, right.
I think it started. And the books were 88 volumes. Sorry, 44 volumes.
Okay, 44 volumes. Wow. I mean, it shows you how much he wrote.
This is published 2002, so it must have started 1999.
Yeah.
And at one stage, we went across to Chinon in France, a group of us, doing some of the late stage work on the books. And this was in a little chateau that Paul Rhodes' wife, who was 40 years his senior and an artist as well, Paul was also an artist, and they hosted us in for a week of going through Vance stuff and agreeing what could be an interpretation that he meant or that the editor didn't like or whatever.
Oh, great.
Trying to restore to what was in Vance's mind. And so it was a pretty monumental effort to produce the 44 volumes.
That's a really unique thing to do for a group to come together and publish the entirety of, as much as they can, the entirety of an author's work, and put that much effort into making it the definitive edition of his books. I can't think of anything similar.
Yeah, I don't know of any other one. Vance was alive when it started, and in fact, we had one meeting in San Francisco at Vance's house, which I went to,
mm-hmm.
and I met him. One time I've met him. I might have met him once in Australia briefly.
He did come to Australia, I think.
I actually did meet him then, I remember now.
Yeah.
And he was blind when I met him, but still as alert and sharp as ever. He hadn't written three of his last books at that stage. Mm. So maybe this started even in a shade earlier than maybe in 97 or something.
Mm, yeah, okay, yeah.
But one of the motivations that Paul Rhodes has, he thought this was one of the great writers in English who was unknown outside a fairly small science fiction world.
Yes.
And he wanted to provide some sort of imprimatur of seriousness about him, even though he's a witty, non-serious writer, but serious in the better sense of that word.
Yep.
And so a proportion of the 44 volumes were donated to some key libraries around the world.
Okay, right.
As part of the process.
Because it's not something you can simply go out and buy, is it? I don't think there were a limited number of printed.
I think you can buy it online now from people selling their copies, but there's no new editions of it.
No.
But what has happened is that the electronic form is now forming the basis of any Jack Vance story that gets reprinted.
Yes.
And so you'll notice if you buy, like, Lioness, the most recent, I think this one here is the VIE, the Vance Interval Edition version of the text.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of his work as e-books because my copies were originally acquired during the 60s and 70s as paper, cheap pulp paperbacks, and of course they just start to brown, and the glue on the spine starts to come apart, and so I disposed of a lot of my paperbacks of his work, but I've replaced them almost entirely, I think, with ebook versions, and that's wonderful. And I do notice that they say they're based on the Vance Integral Edition, so that's good. So the work that was done there is continued to pay fruit, I suppose, pay benefits.
Yeah. And there was published, I don't know, about 10 years ago, a one-volume edition of Lioness in black cover with a detailed introduction by Adam Roberts, rightly extolling the various virtues of Vance in those particular books. And you can probably still have that up on the internet somewhere.
Yes, well, that would be nice to have, yeah. I mean, e-books are all very well, but nothing is quite as nice as being able to turn the pages of a physical book, I think.
That's right.
So I obviously you have a copy of the Vance Integral Edition, so I envy you greatly.
I do. And at the time it cost quite a bit of money.
I'm sure, yeah.
I can't remember how much now. Bit of 44 books. Probably been $1,000.
Yeah, it could easily have been that much.
Something like that.
Or more, yeah, I can imagine. So, but still, and, what a great resource.
Yeah,
that's true.
And I've reread some of these books in that edition.
Yes.
Even though I try to be very careful so they don't get dog-eared or anything like
yes,
that.
Yes, indeed. Oh, well, that's good. No, I think that's an amazing project. I think it testifies the strength of the fan, the strength of his readers, the people who really love his work, that they would go to that much effort to produce a series of volumes like that. So that's good.
Have you read Ruddy's novel from the late 50s called Languages of Power?
Oh, yes, that's a very interesting book. The thesis of that, if I remember rightly, it's a while since I've read it, the thesis of that is that the language you speak affects how you think.
Yeah.
And so there are various languages, and depending on which language you grow up speaking or learn to speak, then your mental attitude to the world is based on that.
Yeah, you're more warlike or more artistic or whatever
the particular language led to you to think. I'm sure there's something in that, I think.
Yeah, and again, that book holds up. I think it's 57 it first came out, and I reread it maybe 5 years ago. It's as powerful as ever.
Sure, yeah.
He's one of the few writers who hasn't aged.
Yes, that's right. You can certainly easily reread his work now with a great deal of pleasure. And you, even with science fiction, there's very little in it which is dated. Quite recently, I reread the Shy novels, and only about 5 years ago, I reread all the Demon Princess novels.
Yeah.
And they do hold up very well to rereading, and they, as you say, they really haven't dated. There's very little in them you could pick out and say, well, that's no longer something which would be right. And, of course, the fantasy novels are even more so because, it's fantasy. So unless you're going to start complaining about the historical accuracy of it, which is nonsense, nothing much is going to change there. I'm very much enjoying rereading Lioness. I say Lioness. I'm really looking forward to finishing the trilogy again, but I didn't quite get that I was hoping to. So,
well, one thing about Lioness is that you've got secular world and you've got the magic world interwoven with each other, so that the magicians, who are very few, aren't allowed to interfere, though some of them find ways around trying to interfere in human politics. And then the King Casimir, who's probably the arch-villain of the book,
yes,
is beautifully, subtly painted, and all his motivations are completely consistent with throughout the three volumes, and similarly each of the other characters in it. And he's got powerful, strong women throughout them as well.
Yes.
Which is in some ways unusual
in
some of the earlier fantasies that were written.
That's right. Well, it starts with Suldrin, who's as a child, but she's very determined and to have her own way in various things, and she's a good, strong female character right from the word go, even though it does things don't work out well for her. But yeah, you're right, there's some very good female characters.
And Madhuk, who features very strongly in the third book called Madhuk.
Right. Yes, that's right.
Is a joy to read about.
No, I'm looking forward to getting to that again. Indeed. All right. Well, I think we've probably covered as much as we can for the podcast. Thank you, Rob. And I should go off and finish reading Lioness. That'll be good.
Okay. But if you can get hold of The View from Chickweed's Window.
Yeah, well, all those crime novels sound good. I must try and find them. Are they still in print? Or?
I'm not sure. That may. I think actually it is in print on demand now.
Oh, okay. That sounds good. Yeah.
If you look on Amazon, maybe that you'll see it there.
All right.
But just briefly on the crime novels, there were three Ed Bain novels set in a fictional county of San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
Then there were some one-off books like Bird Ronald or The View from Chickweed's Window. In The View from Chickweed's Window, it's told from the perspective of it's a young girl who's grew up in China, I think, from missionaries, and she gets sent back to the States at a time of great conflict in the East, and is placed with her rather mean-spirited aunt, who tries to steal the one asset that her parents gave her. But she observes this little boy, Chickweed, and it's only much later that she discovers his story when she tries to get, I suppose, her revenge on her aunt for stealing from her for all those years.
Yeah, I see.
It's a very complex, interesting book. And
I must hunt those up, because it's actually quite interesting that quite a few science fiction writers turn their hand to crime as an alternative genre. I'm thinking about Frederick Brown and people like that. And so it's interesting how there are similarities in some ways between the genres, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was interesting with Frederick Brown, whom I'm reading a bit of at the moment. When I discovered, I knew he had written some crime, but in fact he was a bigger name in crime writing than he was in science fiction. And
yes, that's right.
Science fiction writer.
Yes, I'm thinking of things like Night of the Jabberwock, which is a very funny book.
And, well, this book here, Madball.
Oh, I haven't read that.
Yeah, this is one of those print-on-demand books.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it's a black cat book. Online for $20 or something, it's worth doing.
It's very interesting. I've got a little compilation which includes The Night of the Jabberwocky, The Screaming Mimi, which is a very good book, and The Enchanted Clip Joint or something. What is it? The Fantastic Clip Joint?
Oh, The Clip Joint.
Yeah, I can't remember the actual full title. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think I've got The Clip Joint, whatever it is, somewhere.
Yeah. The Fabulous Clip Joint.
Fabulous Jim Clip
Joint. That's it. Yeah. That's what it's called. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're all great. So, yeah, it's interesting. I say crime and science fiction seem to go together for some of these science fiction authors. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we might wind it up there. We've got lots of interesting material. And thank you very much for being on the podcast. And we'll look forward to having you on again for some other purpose as well. Great.
Thanks very much, David.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks for that, Rob. And that's one of the things I've been reading. I'm almost at the end of rereading the Lioness trilogy. I'm looking forward to getting there.
Well, as we speak, I haven't heard that interview as yet, but I will listen to it. And I'm fully aware that there are a number of blind spots in my knowledge of the science fiction world. Jack Vance is one of them. I've probably read a few bits and pieces by him, but nothing of any length. So I'm probably going to have to rectify that at some point. And this may be the kicker for me to get there and do something about it. So thanks for that, David, and thanks to Rob for the interview. That's great.
Indeed.
Well, that's about it for this episode, David. I think we've rabbited on quite enough, especially me. Next week, we'll get to the short fiction of The Hugos for 2020. Hopefully, that will be shorter. not only just the length of the stories, but also my discussion of them. We'll get through all of that next week. Now, you've read a couple of those as well.
I've read all of those shorter ones. You recommended two of the novellas and two of the short stories,
yeah.
And you thought that they were the best of what's available.
Yes, so we'll discuss what you think about them next week. Yes, don't let it out now, David. Don't let it out now. The interesting thing about the novelettes and short stories, which I'll let people know now, is that none of them were published in any of the big major SF magazines. These are all online publications. And in fact, they are all up there now, available for you online in order for you to be able to read them. So if you want to do a bit of research and have a look, you can probably get to them before I chat about them next week. But hey, or next episode. I keep on saying next week, but you know, next episode.
Yeah, you know what we mean. You know what we
absolutely
mean.
All right, David, thank you very much. Right. I think we're
that's
done.
Pleasure.
That's it. We'll see you again in a fortnight.
We'll indeed. Thanks, Barry.
Take care. Goodbye.